Welcome to Mark and Friends. I'm your host, Donna Leland. And after a wonderful Christmas and holiday break, we are going to pick up on part two, speaking with Michael Rydelnik. He is the author of the book, How Should Christians Think About Israel? A Quick Guide to God's Covenants, Biblical Prophecy, and the Jewish People. It's published by Moody Publishing. Thanks so much, Michael, for joining us again on Mark and Friends. Let's go over that promise in the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, where those who bless Israel will be blessed and those who don't will be cursed.
Well, there are some people who are saying today that Genesis 12:3 says, I will bless those who bless you, Abraham, and will curse those who treat you with contempt, that only applied to Abraham. It's kind of interesting because when the Abrahamic covenant is restated in Genesis 27, it says, God says to the patriarch Jacob, those who curse you will be cursed and those who bless you will be blessed. Now that's interesting. Somehow this is passed on to Jacob. Mm-hmm. And guess what? This is then passed on, we see, from Jacob to his 12 sons who become the fathers of the 12 tribes, and the 12 tribes are Israel. So it does appear that the principle wasn't just for Abraham. It appears, for example, Genesis 24, where it's seemingly applied to all Israel and the Messiah of Israel as well. So the point of it is that this blessing for blessing, curse for curse, is national, not just individual. Mm. And now the Abrahamic covenant is an unconditional promise that God made. In fact, in Genesis 15, we see that when he confirmed the covenant with Abraham, there were these sacrifices and the smoking fire actually passes through. That's the representation of God. And Abraham's in a deep sleep. He's in a coma there, you know, he's out. Yeah. And that means that God alone is obligated to keep the terms of this covenant. And so the promise that God made to Abraham is absolutely still in existence, and we can see it, you know, nationally, individually, that those who bless Israel have been blessed, those who cursed Israel have been cursed. I would say that one of the reasons the United States has been such a blessed country is it's been one of the few places where the Jewish people have had a welcome place. It's scary to me now to see what's going on with the rising anti-Semitism both on the right and the left, because Jew hatred is going to bring a curse, is the idea of bringing a curse on Jewish people, and I think we're jeopardizing our nation if we tolerate this. Mm. But, you know, you could even see what happened with Spain, the greatest naval power on earth, defeated that 1492. They expel all the Jews from Spain. 300,000, the greatest Jewish community in the world at that time, expelled. By 1517, the Spanish Armada defeated, and Spain becomes a second-rate power. It happens over and over again in history that when nations turn against the Jewish community in their midst, when they expel them, when they attack them, anything like that, the result is that God withholds his hand of blessing. He withdraws it.
Mm. Now, does blessing Israel mean that we have to agree with the current government of Israel? Do you offer any thoughts on that? How do we differ the two?
Yeah. Well, first of all, just remember that even in Israel, many people disagree with the government of Israel. Israel, like the United States, is a very divided country in terms of right versus left. And so at least, you know, in fact, they've had difficulty with elections in recent years, not this last government, but in recent years, they've had difficulties even getting a majority for either side. Israel always is divided. So, for example, I have cousins who live in the north of Israel. They can't stand the government. Mm. They oppose the prime minister, but they love Israel. Mm. They love their nation, and they are very strong supporters of Israel. And I think that's important that we recognize that, you know, all of us don't always recognize and agree with, we recognize, but we don't always agree with our government
right.
In the United States. Of course, we can disagree with the government of Israel. Now, that doesn't mean that we automatically attack the government. I think that there's something to be said. A lot of people say, well, I don't agree with this war. Well, I think Israel was compelled. I don't talk about the war in the book, but Israel was compelled to defend itself in this war. And so here's what I think. I have four caveats for how to disagree with the government of Israel. Okay?
Okay.
First of all, we can disagree, but we shouldn't delegitimize the state of Israel. In other words, I may disagree with the government, I may disagree with the prime minister, but that doesn't mean I say Israel shouldn't exist. My second caveat would be not to apply double standards to Israel. Sometimes people say they disagree with Israel and their standard for disagreement, but they don't disagree with Syria, they don't disagree with Nigeria, they don't disagree with any of the other governments, they don't disagree with China. And those countries are doing very seriously wrong things, and they then apply a double standard. They expect perfect righteousness from the government of Israel. No government's going to have that. I do think that Israel has behaved in an amazingly, they've had failures, no doubt about it, but amazingly caring way to try to avoid civilian casualties in this war. And yet every time there's a civilian casualty, which is going to happen in war, it's an aspect of war, people start screaming and applying a double standard to Israel that is not fair. Mm. And the third caveat, besides delegitimizing, not applying double standards, but thirdly, we dare not demonize Israel. There are people who, whatever happens, will demonize Israel. No matter what action they take, it's never good enough. Israel is always fault. People always find fault. In fact, you know, a person may not agree with the prime minister of Israel, but he is being portrayed, for example, right now, as the incarnation of all evil. Mm. That's just not true. So we shouldn't demonize Israel. We shouldn't demonize the government of Israel. There are people in the government that I strongly disagree with. I wish they weren't in the government of Israel. But that doesn't mean we demonize the whole country. And then the lastly is we should beware of believing deceit. So we shouldn't delegitimize. We shouldn't apply double standards. We shouldn't demonize. But so much of the demonization of Israel is based on falsehoods, that the deceit out there, pictures taken that are from other wars. You know, they had pictures of starving children in Yemen.
Yeah.
And they were portrayed as Palestinians starving in Gaza. Now it's come out, now that the war is over, there was no famine in Gaza, although it was stated. There are many things that are done deceitfully. People, pictures, sadly, of suffering people, and it's always portrayed. They're taken from all over the Middle East, and then they're attached to Israel. Many things, you know, Israel was accused of bombing a hospital early in the war. The missiles of Israel, it turns out it was Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and it wasn't even a hospital, it was the parking lot. It wasn't 500 people dead, it was about 20. But it wasn't even Israel that did it. And yet the story went around the world, as Mark Twain would say, before the truth could put on its shoes. Mm. And so we should beware of demonizing Israel based on deceit. And so those are my four caveats. I call it the 4D test of criticizing the government: delegitimization, double standards, and then demonizing and deceit.
That's such a great little peg to hang our thoughts on when it comes to Israel. And again, all this is just feeding in to this rising sense of anti-Semitism. I'm just seeing it all over the media, especially the college campuses. They are just being riled up, and so many others are falling into this. You know,
and
Tucker Carlson
just,
is huge. You know, he is promoting this, and others.
I think what's even more concerning now is on the right, there's this growing hatred of Jewish people. This idea that Israel is controlling the United States and Israel is the biggest danger to the world, especially among young people on the right. And I think that, sadly, Tucker Carlson, he says he's only asking questions, but he platformed a neo-Nazi and gave him a very congenial interview. And also when you hear Tucker, he uses a lot of code words. If you listen to him, when he talks about people, you know that when he talks about globalists, well, that's the ancient Nazi, the old Nazi characterization of Jewish people. And he's always using these kind of subtle terms to undermine and draw people. Everyone knows what he's doing. And he says, I'm not anti-Semitic if I criticize Israel. Yes, That's true. You're not anti-Semitic if you criticize Israel. But if you present deceitful things, one of the things he said is that Israel was deliberately targeting churches in Gaza. Not true. That's using deceit. And then the other thing that he said was that Israel believed in collective guilt, and therefore they were deliberately trying to kill as many Palestinians in Gaza as possible. Absolutely false. Israel did everything they could to keep non-combatants out of harm's way. That's my concern, because people on the right listen to him, they believe him, and unfortunately he's having a growing influence on this. So what do? We have to speak up with the truth. That's, I think, what believers have to do. Donna, you know, of course, I love Founders Week. I had a great opportunity to speak again this year at Founders Week at one of the workshops that we did on Thursday and Friday afternoons. I did both of those. The thing that shocked me the most is how many believers who agree with Moody's doctrine about Israel, they don't believe that the church has replaced Israel, are coming up to me and talking about how do we defend Israel when they're doing such evil things. And I said, what evil things? And so often it was evil things that were not really being done by Israel, but being promoted in the media. And it is heartbreaking for me to see evangelicals succumb to this.
Yeah, it does feel like there is some kind of a mass formation of disinformation. And I think we're, as believers, in that rub of, you know, the Israelites, the Jews, they don't believe in Jesus. So what is some of the biblical evidence that these Jewish people still have these promises from God, even though they have rejected Messiah?
Well, you know, I think that's so interesting, because that's what I keep hearing from evangelicals. Well, Israel, the nation in the Middle East, and the Jewish people, why should we support them? They don't believe in Jesus. And so I think we can make a political argument for support, but theologically, I think it's so important we look at what Romans says. Romans 9 through 11 talks about Jewish people, and it's one of the most important passages for understanding how we should think about Israel. In Romans 9, Romans 11, verse 28 and 29, this is something that's so crucial. It says this: regarding the gospel, they are enemies. Okay, so that doesn't mean they're the enemies of God. It means they're the enemies of the gospel. They're opposed to the gospel. And then Paul says it's for your advantage, for you Gentiles. It's for your advantage. How so? Because of the mostly Jewish national rejection of the Messiah, the gospel went to the Gentiles to make Jewish people jealous. So Paul says it's to your advantage. But then he says, but regarding election, that means chosenness. It's just a big word for chosen. Regarding election, they are loved because of the patriarchs. Now, that refers back to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the Abrahamic covenant. Since God's gracious gifts and calling are irrevocable. And so the gifts that God gave Israel, like the gift of the land and the covenants and his calling for them to be a kingdom of priests that would mediate the knowledge of the God of Israel to the world, none of that goes away. Paul also in Romans 9, when he talks about them all in the present tense, he says they are, and he's talking about Jewish people who don't believe in Jesus. He says that in the first three verses of Romans 9, Paul shows his great heart and compassion for Jewish people. He says, if only I could go to hell so they could go to heaven, I would do it. But then he says, they are Israelites. And this is all present tense. To them belong the adoption, Israel, my son, Exodus 4. The glory, the Shekinah glory of God present with them. The covenants, Abrahamic, and the Davidic covenant. Even the new covenant was cut with Israel. The giving of the Torah. The temple service, Levites and priests, the promise of the land, the promise of the Messiah, the ancestors or the patriarchs are theirs. And from them, by physical descent, came the Messiah, who is God over all. You know, this is the hardest thing for me to comprehend about believers being hateful of the Jewish people, when their Messiah is Jewish. And his response to Jewish unbelief was not isolation or hate. It was compassion. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I would have gathered you as a mother hen gathers her chicks. It says in Luke 19:41 through 44 that Jesus looked at Jerusalem and he wept over the city because of its unbelief. His reaction wasn't anger. It wasn't punishment. It wasn't repudiation. It was weeping, sorrow over Israel's great unbelief.
I'm so thankful God has not turned his back on Israel, because that's such a confidence that we have now as believers. He's not going to turn his back on us. He is a covenant-keeping God, and we owe them so much. I mean, they went through all the temple sacrifices, and they had to live with all these washings and cleansings. And so that's why I am just so in awe that God has kept these, you know, Jewish presence in our world, pretty much as evidence of his kindness, his goodness, his faithfulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think it's so evident that God has his hand on his people. We think about all the benefits Jewish people have brought to the world every time someone doesn't have polio, yeah. Jonas Salk's polio vaccine. There are many blessings that Israel brought to the world. Israel was supposed to be a blessing for the world, and the Jewish people have. I mean, every time you pick up your cell phone, if that is a blessing, your mobile phone, that's from Israel as well. When your computer isn't attacked from the outside because there's a firewall, that's from Israel as well. There's so many benefits that Israel has brought to the world, but the knowledge of the God of Israel, the fact that, you know, those of us who are followers of Jesus, you know, so often we forget that we are believing in the Messiah of Israel, because he came from the Jewish people, and we believe in the God of Israel. That knowledge came from the Hebrew Scriptures that we received from the Jewish people. So, yeah, I think that sometimes we forget, we don't just forget the compassion and heart that the Lord Jesus had for his people, but we forget the benefits that they have brought to us.
And of course, the Messiah is the number one. They kept their, yep, you know, physical body pure, you know, a body you have prepared for me. How did that body, yep, come about? Well, through the Jewish people, because of their meticulous attention to all those regulations that kept their DNA clean so that, mm-hmm, our Messiah could come to us.
And you know, I have to say, I'm going to put that in God's hands, because God's the one that preserved the Jewish people. It's why he will always preserve the Jewish people. He preserved the Jewish people so the Messiah come in his first coming and redeem us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the key to the second coming is when Israel will call for him. Matthew 23:37-39, when Jesus says, I would have gathered you as a mother hen gathers her chicks, but now your house is being left you desolate. The temple is going to be destroyed. Jerusalem will be destroyed, he says. But then he says, until you say, you know, you won't see me again. I'm not going to return until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And he tells that to Jerusalem. That phrase, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, is a phrase of welcome in Hebrew, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. It's always welcome. And what Jesus is saying is, I'm not returning at the end of the tribulation until Israel welcomes me back. Israel is the key to the second coming. And so often we neglect that, and we don't see that God's going to preserve this people so they can indeed welcome him back. And he will return to Jerusalem, just as Zechariah 14 says. He'll stand on the Mount of Olives and protect his people when they put their trust in him.
So he's preserving them so he can then fulfill these prophecies.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Mm, wow. Let's think about Galatians 3:16 for a minute. Okay. It teaches that Jesus is the true Israel.
And he is. He's the epitome. He is the incarnation of all that is promised to Israel. But I think that sometimes people kind of miss what that actually is saying. They want to say that since Jesus is the true Israel, that all the promises that God made to the nation of Israel are not being fulfilled. And the only way to grasp that, I think, is to go back to Genesis 22, because that's what Paul's thinking about. In Genesis 22, verses 16 through 18 is really where you get the background to understand Galatians 3:16. So I'm turning in my Bible here to Genesis 22. Here's what it says. First, God says, this is after Abraham offered Isaac. He says, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your seed," that's literally what it says, "as numerous as the stars of the sky and the sand of the seashore, your seed." Now that's the interesting, it's a new sentence. So here's what he says, "I'm going to bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars." So that's obviously talking about the nation of Israel, yeah. Numerous descendants, right? But then it says, so that's the idea of the word seed is being used collectively of the whole nation. But then it says, your seed, now this, that second sentence, in Hebrew there's a grammatical idea where there's a continuation of thought or a new thought. Well, this is not the continuation of thought. Here's a new thought.
Mm.
It says, your seed will possess the gates of his enemies. That's something that was talking about the Messiah. There's going to be one of your many offspring. One will possess the gates of your enemies. And through your seed, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. Basically, what it's saying is, I'm going to make you a great nation, many a collective seed, and then there's going to be one seed of that many that will bless the whole world.
You've helped us think through so much, separating the Jewish people from government, from not listening to lies. And so to sum it up, why should Christians today care about Israel and the Jewish people?
Because this is what God would have us do.
Yeah.
I think that's it. God,
yes.
God cares deeply. The Messiah Jesus cares deeply for his people. The Apostle Paul cared deeply for his people. Why should we care about Israel? Because God cares, and he will bless us if we care.
We're listening to Michael Rydelnik, and we're talking about his book, How Should Christians Think About Israel? Helping us to wrap our brain around our current situation when it comes to some of the thoughts and the rhetoric that's being spewed concerning this group of people. Well, thank you again so much, Michael, for taking time out. I know your busy schedule.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate you so much. Thank you so much for joining us here on Mark and Friends.